Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Almost half of adults in the United States will experience a mental illness at some point in our lifetimes. These can be conditions ranging from prolonged grief to the very common instances of depression and anxiety. Some of us will suffer from what is known as serious mental illness, conditions like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia that drastically alter a person's ability to function. My guest today has long-standing bipolar disorder, and one of her previous books called Manic, a Memoir, became a New York Times bestseller. She now has a new memoir called Modern Madness, an Owner's Manual. Terry Cheney is a former Hollywood entertainment lawyer who's become a well-known mental health advocate through her writing, speaking, and fundraising. For a long time, she wrestled with the decision about whether to go public with her illness, fearing the shame and stigma associated with it, but she has never looked back. Cheney wrote a column for the New York Times weekly Modern Love section about how her bipolar disorder made it difficult to maintain relationships, and it was recently turned into a limited television series on Amazon, and the actress Anne Hathaway portrayed Cheney. In today's show, we'll talk about what bipolar disorder is, how it manifests, and ways to treat it. You should know that many people suffering with bipolar disorder attempt suicide, as my guest today did and is quite candid about. I want to offer these resources if you are in need of help. The National Suicide Hotline is 800-273-8255, or you can text HOME, H-O-M-E, on your cell phone to 741-741. Here in Tulsa, you can always call COPES 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 918-744-4800. Mental health advocate and memoirist Terry Cheney is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Terry Cheney, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start by having you just tell us how you define bipolar disorder, what it is and what it means to you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, and I'm really excited to be on NPR in Oklahoma. My definition of bipolar disorder is, if you think of a roller coaster of emotions, you can go from very high, very euphoric and blissful and charismatic to extremely low, what most people know of as really, really bad depression. But there are stages in between. So it's not just all mania and depression, but that's the general format of it.
How old were you when you received that diagnosis?
You know, I was 34 years old when I received my bipolar diagnosis, but before that, I was diagnosed with major depression. It took about 10 years, as quite often does, to receive the correct bipolar diagnosis. But I knew, even when I was a child, that there was something very different. I don't want to say wrong, but very different about me, because I would have these extended periods of absence from school or work and just be unable to get out of bed, followed up by tremendous periods of productivity where I'd do all sorts of extra credit reports and, you know, make straight A's and be valedictorian. So it was, even back then, it was a roller coaster.
And, you know, you touched on something there that's very important, which is the initial diagnosis was depression, which it sounds like it certainly was, but it took maybe many years for you to get this diagnosis of bipolar, and you stated that that is very common. Why do you think it takes so long for people to get the diagnosis? Is it just because you have to kind of evince the behavior, both sides of the behavior?
I think it's two reasons. First of all, you need to establish a pattern of moods for bipolar disorder, because you do have those, you know, patterns of escalation and then depression and then escalation again, cycling, we call it. And that takes time to really figure out that landscape. But I think it's largely because who goes into their doctor when they're manic? They're feeling on top of the world. So why would they visit a doctor? So the poor doctor just sees you when you're wallowing in depression and naturally, prescribes for major depression.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about mania, because you just said who goes to the doctor when they're feeling manic, and you write so evocatively about when you are in a manic state. I guess, can you share with us what that's like? I mean, and you feel maybe that you can do no wrong, or you feel like you can take on the world. What is that like?
Well, that describes it pretty well. There's actually two forms of mania. There's a lesser state of mania called hypomania, which I think is what most people think of as mania. And that is when you just are at the top of your game. You're making connections between things. You're so charismatic. I mean, when I'm hypomanic, men love me, women love me, animals, squirrels love me. It doesn't matter. I can charm anyone off the trees. And that can escalate, though, into true mania. And that is not so pleasant because you're irritable and you become very reckless. Financially, I personally spent all my money during a manic episode, and you don't have much regard for the law or for customs or conventions. And unfortunately, you don't remember quite often what you did when you were manic. It's almost like being a blackout drunk. So you come back, you crash back down to earth, and you have all these consequences that follow you. So mania is not all it's cracked up to be. Hypomania is, but mania is not.
And when you say it's like being a blackout drunk and you don't remember it, I mean, do you remember it as it's happening? I mean, that's a strange question, but are you in the moment, or is it just you feel like you're depersonalized as if you're somebody else?
No, I think you don't actually depersonalize or dissociate, but the moment is speeding so fast. Everything is going so quickly. Your thoughts, your speech, everything around you just seems to be hyped up. And I don't know why you don't remember. I don't know what the chemical mechanism of that is. But it, for me, anyway, I have to piece things together by the sales receipts. I have to say, oh, I must have been in Big Sur because there's the Big Sur Cafe on my credit card. You know, it's pretty awful.
Wow. Well, actually, you wrote about one experience where you combine this spending spree with law enforcement. I think it was at the Santa Monica Pier, and you talk about this young woman singing Ave Maria, I think it was, and you shower her with all your money, but it winds up not going so well. Can you relate
right.
that?
Right. Unfortunately, I was manic, and she was singing just beautifully on the promenade at the Third Street Pavilion, which is an outdoor shopping center. So I just dumped all the money from my purse into her hat, and somebody came and stole it. So I had to run after him, and I unfortunately ran into a cop, which is the last person in the world you want to see when you're manic, because you don't have much respect for, as I said, the law or law enforcement. And I just had to keep running. You run away a lot in mania from consequences.
Yeah, I was really surprised, I guess, at the turn that it took, where you basically kind of told the policeman off, and then essentially he asked you for some identification, and you basically bolted, and you just fled
right.
and ran away.
Which is not something I would ever do if I was in my proper mind. I'm a lawyer, after all. I was an entertainment lawyer, so I have a high regard for police, but not when I'm manic.
Well, let's talk for a minute about that. You were a lawyer, as you said, an entertainment lawyer, and I guess by way of your biography, I know you represented some very famous clients, but you kept your bipolar disorder a secret for many, many years, and I guess you relate that in your prior memoir, Manic, a memoir, where you sort of, it was your coming out, as it were, and releasing the truth. So I guess, why did you keep it a secret, and tell us what went into trying to keep it secret?
Sure. Well, I was an entertainment lawyer for about 16 years, and I represented clients like Michael Jackson, Quincy Jones, the major motion picture studios. So I was very successful on the outside, but all the time I was struggling with this very severe case of bipolar disorder, and I kept it secret from everyone except my doctors because I thought, now this was back in the 80s and early 90s, the stigma was so profound back then that I thought I would lose my job. I'd be ostracized from society. I'd never work again. And particularly because I had a rather high profile job, you know, that terrified me. So I just had to keep it secret. I would hide out under my desk sometimes when I was really depressed and crying and just not answer the phone or answer the door when people knocked on it. So what happened was I was hospitalized finally for the worst suicide attempt I ever made, a worst period of depression. And during that time, I started to write about my illness and what it felt like inside my own body. And I found that so helpful so that I could describe it to the doctors, because there really isn't a vocabulary for mental illness. It isn't something people talk about much in polite society. So 7 years later, I realized I had a book, and it was manic, and it outed me, but it also shot up to the New York Times bestseller list. So it was a frightening experience to publish it, but it's just been nothing but good things since then.
It's good to hear that, of course, that you know, being your authentic self has been positive in spite of taking that leap of faith and that big risk. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Terry Chaney. She's author of the new book, Modern Madness, an Owner's Manual. She's a mental health advocate and writer based in Southern California. And Terry, you mentioned that you were hospitalized and had a suicide attempt. You've had actually several suicide attempts. Is that right?
Yes, I have, unfortunately.
Is that, it comes with the territory, in a sense, with bipolar disorder?
You know, there are statistics that say up to 50%, between 25 and 50%, which is kind of a big range, of people with bipolar disorder will attempt suicide at least once in their lives. But you will have suicidal ideation in about 75% of people with bipolar.
Wow. And you have known some people who've taken their lives, right?
Yes, I have, which is so sad. It was quite a shock.
Yeah. And we will link on our website to the National Suicide Hotline. There's also a local Tulsa resource, which is COPES, which is available 24 hours, 7 days a week at 918-744-4800. The National Suicide Hotline also has a text line where you can text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. We talked about the extremes of bipolar. There's mania and there's depression. And of course, you mentioned hypomania, which is in some ways maybe the ideal, where you feel highly productive, but in control. But you wrote very well about something you call mixed state, and the mixed state. And that was, frankly, that was new to me. Can you describe what that's like?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's new to most people, and it was certainly new to me for many, many years. I didn't discover it from my doctors. I had to do my own research. A mixed state is the collision of manic and depressive symptoms, where, for example, you could be feeling extremely down and hopeless and full of self-loathing and self-hatred, but you combine that with the energy of mania and the irritability and the impulsivity, and that is a perfect storm. That is when the most suicides occur. So it's a terrible place to be, and it's very hard to treat, because you're looking at this, you know, melange of symptoms happening all at once. It's also more common than people realize. 40% of bipolar people will experience a mixed state.
And so, at least in the book, you write about cycling, which is going back and forth from, you know, along the continuum from depression to mania and back again.
Correct.
With all these years of experience and all the research you've done and writing, do you have any sense of when the moods will change, or have you developed, this is maybe two big questions, have you developed any way to help yourself change the moods,
sure,
or is it something that's just completely, you know, beyond any kind
no,
of
trick? No, I actually, and I think this would be true of many bipolar people, I've developed a pattern that I recognize in myself. I keep very close track of my moods. I keep a journal with my, you know, with my moods in them. And I'm what they call a rapid cycler, so that I cycle quite quickly from one mood to another. I could do it even within the course of a day. But for me, usually the depressive episodes will last 4 days and the manic episodes will last 3 days, which I think is very lucky in a way, because I don't have to be in those states forever. I know people who have depressive episodes or manic episodes that last for months, and I can't even begin to imagine that. But that's been self-education. The most important thing, though, for me has been alerting my friends and family to this, because when I'm in a depression, I'm convinced, I don't care what the evidence is otherwise, I'm convinced it will last forever. That is just the hallmark of depression. It's going to last forever. You are never going to feel better. Things will never change. So when I have a loved one tell me, okay, Terry, your cycles are 4 days, you got to make it till Thursday, and then you're going to feel different, that is invaluable. I don't know what I would do without my friends and my family to help me with that.
So in other words, that signpost can be really helpful in terms of the cognitive aspect, overcoming, in a sense, not
yes,
overcoming maybe, but at least
getting through it, enduring it. It can be life-saving. Yeah.
Because you also wrote about when you're depressed, how you really want to be alone. You don't want anyone knocking on the door, coming to visit, bringing food or cookies or flowers. But what you do want is just a simple, and you also, interestingly, don't want people to avoid you, ignore you.
Right.
You want sort of that it's a little bit of a needle that has to be thread. You want people to acknowledge you but not be intrusive. Is that a...
It's a bit of a mixed message, I'll give you that. And I feel for my family and friends on this one because I don't want to be pressured to do anything because I'm feeling enough pressure already in my own mind. But I do want people to check in. Just a simple email or a text or a phone call that just says, I'm thinking of you, this will pass, I love you, this will pass. That's all I need. I just need to know that there are people who care, that my own dark truth at that moment isn't the only truth.
Okay, well, I want to shift a little bit to the resources. Well, first of all, I want to compliment you on the book and also that you have an appendix in the book with many resources in it for your readers, places
Thank
they can
you.
Turn for advice, articles they can read, books, also a number of nonprofit organizations that help with mental illness or bipolar disorder or suicidality. And, you know, you refer in the book when you get yourself or get into trouble emotionally, you will call your psychopharmacologist. And so I wanted you to walk us through that. What is the difference between your therapist and your psychopharmacologist and how you resource them or how you think about them differently?
Well, a psychopharmacologist is a medical specialist, a psychiatrist who specializes in the management of your psychiatric medication. So it's a real privilege to have one. I get a little frustrated with the fact that most psychiatric medications are prescribed by primary care doctors because I think it's really an art form and you need someone who deals with these medications on a daily basis, knows you, knows your symptoms and your triggers and your history. And not all primary care doctors have the luxury of being able to really be that involved. So it is a great privilege and honor to have a good psychopharmacologist on hand. My therapist, who I see weekly, really helps me deal with the consequences of having a mental illness, the social difficulties that arise from it, or my own personal feelings of lack of self-worth or self-esteem. I've been seeing the same therapist for 30 years, I think, or 25 years, and he's retiring, unfortunately. So I'm quite sad about that.
Wow. I mean, that's an unusual, in this day, an unusually long relationship with someone. There's probably a half a dozen times in the book you mentioned calling your psychopharmacologist for an alteration in a dosage
Correct.
Or a change in medication. And I guess I was wondering, how often do you change medication, or have you been able to find a stable regimen of whether it's one or two or three medicines that help you? Or, you know, why change, or what, you know,
sure.
Obviously if it's not working, I suppose.
We call it tweaking the meds. Right now I'm on there's also a term we use, a cocktail of medications. I'm on several different drugs that just seem to work together for me. And that's very common for people, that they will be on more than one drug. Some of my drugs address the side effects of other of my drugs. So that's not ideal, but it's a reality. You tweak the meds because, for example, sometimes my sleep is bad and I might need to adjust the dosage on one of my drugs, or I'm feeling more depressed than usual, or I'm in a time of extreme pressure, or, you know, just just in life, things are not going well and I'm not handling it well. So I would call the doctor and we would work together to find, you know, maybe just a little bit more of this or a little bit less of that. And I find that something else that really doesn't happen enough is people need to call their doctor and be in communication with him, because he can't know how to really help you unless you're telling him what's going on. I think there's this white coat worship in America where people are afraid of their doctors. And that just is a shame, because with mental illness, it's a constantly changing game and you have to keep up with it.
Yeah, well, it's an excellent point. You talked about how you were a lawyer for 16 years and wound up hospitalized, and it was at that juncture of your life where you started writing, and eventually you said, I think it was 8 years later, became your memoir, which became a bestseller.
Right.
But along the way, you had a, I don't know if it was an excerpt or a seed kernel of the book, but you wrote a column that was printed in the New York Times in a section that's called Modern Love. And so people
right.
who read the New York Times know that that's a staple of their Sunday Styles section. And they're always very interesting essays. Some of those columns were selected and turned into prestige television. They took about 10 of the columns and turned them into dramatizations. And your column was one of those that was selected, and none other than the actress Anne Hathaway played you in the how much of the I saw that episode before this your book ever came my way. I was wondering how truthful was the portrayal on television of it, or was it sort of altered to, you know, dramatize it for the sake of TV?
No, it was, first of all, it was quite a thrill and an unexpected one. To have Anne Hathaway play you is, you know, I think every woman's dream. It was very true to life because in this particular episode, more so than all the others, there were eight of them actually, it was dealing with mental illness. And I contacted the producers and said, you know, we really need to be accurate about this because it's so important. And you have such an opportunity here to educate people. And they were all for it. They wanted just as accurate a depiction as possible. And Anne was extremely interested in that. She and I talked on the phone, and I talked with the director. So I told Anne about what it felt like inside my body, because that's sort of my thing I like to write about, what it really feels like inside. And she just was amazing in her portrayal, particularly, I mean, I loved how she portrayed mania as singing and dancing in public. I could never do that, but the way she does. But her portrayal of depression was just spot on. There's a scene where she's in the bathroom getting ready for a date, and the mascara wand just becomes too heavy to hold. It's just too much of a burden, and she crumples to the floor in tears. And I'll tell you, I just even talking about that, I tear up a little bit because she really got it. That's what it's like.
I remember that. It was very powerful, the depression side of it, because she was holed up in her bed for days or weeks. And as you point out, I mean, people from work can't find her. She's made an acquaintance at work, and the acquaintance, I guess, thinks, you know, what did I do wrong here, or why aren't you my friend? And of course, this does involve the mysterious man in the grocery store with whom she's starting a relationship, but it quickly goes away. And I should just say the name of that column is Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am. That was the title of the Modern Love essay back in 2008. But very interesting that it turned into very good television.
Powerful.
Yeah, very, very powerful. And I mean, quite a those eight episodes, as you said, I'm sorry, I said 10, had quite a cast. Each episode had different actors, but many of them, Oscar or Emmy winners in many of those episodes.
Tina Fey, for example. Yeah.
Tina Fey, and yes, exactly. I wanted to ask about your advocacy. So as you point out, you were a lawyer and became a writer and a mental health advocate, and you're involved with many organizations. But what reforms would you like to see as far as advocating for mental illness? You know, how can we continue to improve?
Well, there's something that particularly frustrates me, and it's the insurance reimbursement of mental health conditions. Now, we're supposed to have what they call parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y, meaning mental health problems are treated and reimbursed to the same extent as physical complaints. Well, that's the theory, but I don't think it's actually happening in practice as much as it should. Here in California, we just this past week, I think, a bill that will give more teeth to parity standards. But the brain is an organ, you know, it's a physical organ. I don't think mental health should be treated any differently than physical health. It's already expensive enough, and people do need insurance help with it. So that notion of parity, the equal access to care and treatment as a legal right, I think is not there yet, and it needs to be.
I wanted to also ask you how you have been coping with the pandemic. So are you going out? Are you staying in? How has it affected your mental health? I mean, it's had certainly had an effect, it seems, on all of our mental health just because of how it's changed or appended our lives.
Sure.
But, you know, we're seeing lots more isolation, especially among, you know, our elders or people who are living in facilities and things.
Well, it's rather ironic because isolation is usually a symptom of depression, and I'm really good at isolating. So I feel like I've sort of been in training for this much of my life. So I think I've responded to COVID maybe better than most people have. It just is not that big a difference for me since I'm a writer and I'm single and I'm used to isolating. But I hear that from my readers as well, that, you know, what we experience on a day-to-day basis, the sense of frustration and hopelessness and fear of the future and the unknown, those are things that people are just now beginning to experience themselves, even if they've never struggled with mental illness. So ironically, I think COVID is going to have a positive impact on mental health stigma, because you have all these people who are experiencing depression and anxiety right now, and I think there will be a greater compassion for that and a greater awareness of just the essential function that mental health plays in our daily lives. I mean, it really, you can't have health without mental health.
Well, you, no spoilers here, but you end the book with some notes on hope. And I guess if I could ask you to sort of summarize, you know, it's a memoir because you certainly talk about your own experiences, your own feelings, your own memories, but also are giving advice in this book, I think, both for people with bipolar disorder or with mental illness who suffer from stigma, but also for their loved ones or people who seek to better understand them. And so what are some of the hopes? And you mentioned one there with COVID, that might, again, lead to greater parity and greater or diminishment of stigma. Are there other hopeful notes you can leave us with?
I just think there's so much more awareness of mental health than there used to be. I'm really thrilled to see that with the disclosures of celebrities and everyday people starting to talk about their mental health as a matter of course. I think we're really seeing, as you say, a diminishment of stigma in a way that I certainly didn't predict when I wrote Manic in 2008. So I'm now in 2020 finding it a very changed picture. I think that as more people come out and put a familiar face on an unfamiliar disease, we're going to see a lot of things change. I don't think we'll be able to emerge from the times that we're going through unchanged. And I personally believe that's grounds for hope.
Well, Terry Chaney, I really appreciate your candor and your honesty and your resilience. Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you so much for reading the book. I really appreciate that.
Terry Chaney is a mental health advocate and writer. Her new book is called Modern Madness, an Owner's Manual, and we spoke to her from Los Angeles. For anyone in need, the National Suicide Hotline can be reached at 800-273-8255. Locally, you can always call COPES 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 918-744-4800. If you prefer text, text the word HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.